So let's take a look at what quantum theory is all about. Well, we have states, which can also be represented by density matrices, in the case of weak states. Density matrices are operators on a product space. We have unitary operators, projection operators. More generally, we have something called super operators. Super operators, we call it. What else do we have? We have tensor products.
Oh yeah, it's a super operators when we call it CP maps.
Okay, CP maps.
That's it. Or CP positive maps.
CP positive maps.
Does that still ring a bell? Or does it still doesn't ring a bell? So the emotion is nothing to carry.
Yeah, so you can think of unitary operators and projection operators as being special cases of completely positive maps. And completely positive maps extrapolate between these two cases of minimum cases as well. Okay. So, well, maybe that's not everything, but this gives you some idea of the sort of flavor of what quantum monism looks like. And I think the natural reaction to this is to go, you know, like, wow, where did that come from? I mean, it's really abstract. I think it's good to have natural reactions, tells you that it sort of makes you think. I make many chances in reality. I think that this is an extremely abstract formalism. If you look at physics before this, well, you know, there was a certain intuitive nature to it, and suddenly we have this thing. So let's think about that. Let's compare the two situations that we have. Okay. Is it okay now?
Right.
It says, oh, yeah. It can't be too loud, though, I noticed. Is that okay? Okay, good. Right, so there's what we have. We have this very abstract quantum formalism. And we don't really know where it comes from. Of course, that doesn't stop people trying to interpret it, which is a good thing to do. So I think maybe an even better thing to do rather than trying to interpret it is, first of all, to try and ask, you know, to ask where it comes from. So let me look at some historical examples. We have Kepler's laws. We have these laws of planetary motion. Very nice, simple laws, but wasn't really clear where they came from. I think you've probably covered Kepler's laws at some point about equal areas being swept out at equal times, and the motion of the planets is along an ellipse, and so on. So here we have a set of laws that might have been regarded as somewhat abstract. And then Gibson came along with his laws of mechanics and his universal gravitational law, and was able to account for Kepler's laws. Okay, so we saw going from something abstract to something more intuitive. And another example would be the Lorentz transformations. So Lorentz had noticed that Maxwell's equations were invariant under a certain rather strange-looking set of transformations. Taken by themselves, they're rather abstract. There's no reason why nature would be described by those rather strange transformations rather than the more simple Galilean transformations. That is until Einstein came along with his two postulates. One postulate saying the laws of physics and saying no reference strength, and the other one, the crucial one, saying that that the speed of light is constant measured in any reference frame. Okay, so when we did that, we got a kind of simplification, but also something else happened. Well, so I suppose two things happened. One thing that happened is we had a sense of understanding what was going on. We got a kind of cozy feeling. It's nice when you understand what's happening. The other thing that happened is that we were able to go on beyond whatever it was we started with. So in the case of Kepler's laws, Newton went on beyond that and discovered mechanics which was applicable in a whole range of different areas, well beyond just planetary motion. And in the case of the Lorentz transformations, special relativity already had things like E equals mc squared in it, which went beyond the Lorentz transformations, but it also took him on to general relativity. So it seems that if we ask questions like, where does the formalism come from? Not only do we get a cozy feeling, but we might be able to go beyond the present formalism. Okay. So I'm going to present five axes. I don't want to put myself quite on the same footing as these two guys. And I don't think what I've done is quite anything like successful, but I think it's in the right direction. Or even these two guys. I think it's in the right direction. I think it's an attempt to start to understand where this kind of formalism comes from. Okay, so that's the sort of background. So the question, of course, is can we do this for quantum theory? Can we do something similar? So let's start by asking what quantum theory is. Well, of course, quantum theory is this abstract formalism. But more than that, So what is quantum theory? Well, quantum theory is a quantum theory is probabilistic calculus. When I say a calculus, I mean it's a system for calculating probabilities. It's the thing that we have at the top. It's just a way of calculating probabilities. So given that, we might compare it with something we had already before we got to quantum theory. We had classical probability theory. So if you think of it like this, here is classical probability theory. And then that can be applied to classical physics. So in here we have things like Newton's laws, Maxwell's equations. We have statistical mechanics. Okay, and all those areas in classical physics that we know and love. Okay, this is a sort of meta theory that we can apply down here. So quantum theory is a similar thing. It's a meta theory which we can apply to quantum physics. And there are lots of examples of quantum physics. For example, quantum field theory, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. If you look at solid state physics, many different places where we apply quantum theory. The quantum theory is a sort of meta theory that applies to these different things. It might make more sense to call it quantum probability theory. Yeah, I'm not going to do that, but it might make more sense. It just emphasizes the fact that we've got a calculus for calculating probabilities that we can apply to many different physical situations, just like we have a classical probability calculus. So, as you say, I'm happy to take questions during this talk. Are any questions or points on the one that wants to raise it? Everything should be simple. I'll try and make it more complicated still. Okay. So that's what quantum theory is. It's probability calculus, and we can look at probability calculus in general. So let's consider what kind of scenario we're talking about. Well, here's the kind of scenario we want to think about. We have a situation where we have some kind of preparation. So we're preparing a quantum system or a general system. We're not necessarily talking about quantum theory here. There's the thing we're preparing. And then we have a transformation. And then we have a measurement. Okay. And actually, we could continue this. Actually, we could have many boxes where we make many transformations and measurements. So we could carry on here. But let's just take this simple case. So the preparation, well, that's a box. It has various knobs and things we can adjust. So here's a knob that we can adjust. So an example in quantum theory might be that you have a laser. Yeah, please.
Sorry, I'd just like to go back to the first one. This is the two pictures that you draw there kind of are mysterious to me, because in the quantum theory we have ways of calculating dynamics. So we can, it's not just the classical probability theory, like say we know that there's a certain distribution of outcomes now, there's no way out of control probability theory how we can obtain like quantum theory distribution, say in the future. There's
some
input coming in probability theory.
Okay, so actually, I'm going to come to this. It's a very good point. The thing I want to call classical probability theory is something which is rich enough to include transformations. Okay, particularly rich enough to include the effect of the second box. And I'll explicitly give you the form of that kind of structure in a little while. Okay, but it's a very good point. And I think, certainly, if you think of classical probability theory as just being the common world of axioms. Okay, we'd actually apply equally well to quantum theory in a problem with them. If you think of classical probability theory but just being that, or some set of axioms equivalent to that, which is what you normally learn, then sure, we're missing the transformation aspect, we're missing the evolution aspect. But I think quantum classical probability theory can demonstrate to be a slightly richer structure. And I'll explain that in a moment. Okay. So we have preparations. We have transformations. Okay, and again, we have a knob which we can use to vary the actual transformation that we're implementing. So in the case of preparation, this might be, for example, we have an oven which emits atoms. Okay, and then we prepare atoms. And maybe we also perform some filtering on the atoms, so we just collect atoms at a certain velocity and a certain spin. A transformation might be some magnetic field applied to those to that atom, which changes the spin, for example. And then we have a measurement. So it might, for example, the measurement might be a Stern-Dolak apparatus, which is used to measure the spin of the atom or something of that sort. The measurement will have certain outcomes. So if it was a Stern-Dolak apparatus, we'd get this outcome would correspond to getting spin up along a certain direction, and this one would spin down. There's also, I want to just add a little bit of extra structure. This isn't necessary, I'm just adding it for the sake of making the exposition clearer. Here I have what I call a release button. Okay. And the idea is that if you press the release button, then the system is released. Okay, and then there's, for example, the atom carries on through the system. And if we emit a transformation device, that implies that you'll always get one of these certain results here. Okay, not this result here, I call it the null result. So an example, just to put all this in terms of an example, here's a cavity with some devices which select a certain
certain skin and a certain speed. Here are some magnetic fields. And then here is a stone Dalek apparatus, which has detects a particle here or here. Okay. And there's one outcome where the particle is detected here, one where the particle is detected here, and one outcome where the particle isn't detected. Okay, and that's the null result. Okay. So any questions?
What's the little bubble beside the preparation box?
Okay, this one here. Okay, so this isn't really well this isn't something you're directly seeing. This is meant to represent the system, like the atom or whatever it is. So I deliberately draw it through like this because we don't know what this is. I mean, this is what this is depends on your interpretation of quantum theory. You might even say it's not there. It might just be a way of thinking about this experiment. What time should I aim to finish?
3:45.
Okay, that's under my hour 3 minutes. Okay. Are there any more questions? Because it's quite useful to get speaking to yourself about what you're talking about now. Okay. Actually, it might be worth introducing the first axiom at this stage. Okay, and let's bring along the slabs of concrete I have, the slabs of stone I have for this purpose, but just use the last one.
Okay.
So we want to construct a theory of probability. Well, we need it to be the case that it makes sense to talk about probability. And you know, if you're at all interested in the concept of probability, you should look at some of the philosophical literature on it. It's an extremely problematic concept, and it's extremely troublesome from my point of view that this philosophically very problematic subject, probability, is actually right at the very heart of modern physics. In a way which seems unavoidable. But we're not going to worry about that. What we're going to do is write down an axiom which will suffice for our purposes. So let's see. So consider. Imagine we take the limit, where we take the number of times we see a particular outcome, okay, so L labels a particular outcome, divided by the total number of times we've run the experiment. And we divide those two numbers, okay, we call this thing P. Okay. And imagine we do this on Monday, and we get a certain answer for this. Okay. Of course, strictly speaking, we can't take this limit to infinity. We have to take it to some very large number. Okay, now imagine we do the same thing again on Tuesday. Same preparation, same measurement. Okay, then we take it as an axiom that we'll get the same answer. Yes. So this will be, for example, if you take a point and you touch the point a million times on Monday and you get heads in a certain fraction of those cases, say 45% of those cases you get heads. And then you do the same thing again on Tuesday, you expect to get the same fraction, 45%. Okay. The law doesn't have to be like that, there's no reason logically the law would have to have this property. But if it isn't like this, we just can't even begin to do probability theory. This isn't, if you do look at the literature on the philosophy of probability, this isn't a really very sophisticated way of stating this kind of property, and it's actually very problematic to give a good statement of this. I'm just going to take that as given and not worry about it anymore.
You're scaling out time, like the day of the week when you do the experiment, not like, you know, the lab where you do the experiment. I mean, there's going to be a whole bunch of other spatial, and there's a whole bunch of coordinates that are going to be irrelevance.
So this hinges on what you mean by preparation and measurement. So you kind of set up, you're really setting up a equivalence class of things you want to call the same preparation, and likewise for measurement. And then you'll say that that itself can be taken from one day to the next, or from one run to the next. So there's certainly issues that one would want to address there. Of course, I mean, those are issues you're going to have to, I mean, those are the same issues you're facing, just in quantitative as it stands, but one would want to, if one was going to spell this out, which is something I'm addressing in the current work, but you'd want to be really careful about what that means. Are there any more questions? Maybe I should say something about why this concept is problematic. Imagine if you take the example of a coin. You have a coin which has apparently 45% on its given heads. So imagine you toss the coin. Imagine you believe an individual run for the probability of getting heads is 45%. If you toss the coin, you get heads. I think you're not especially surprised. Because the probability that was 45%. You toss it again, you get heads again. Okay, fine, that's not surprising. You keep repeating that. At a certain point, maybe you've got heads a million times. Okay, and you thought the probability was 45%. So what are you going to do? You could say, well, no, probably it wasn't 45%. It was actually 100%. Or you could say, no, I really believe it was 45%. I did an analysis of this coin. I looked at the properties of this coin. It seemed to be 45%. All that's happened is it had an extremely unlikely run of events, extremely unlikely sequence of events. So you'll say it's very unlikely that you'd get all heads in that case. The problem is that you're using the concept of likelihood in trying to define the concept of probability. And all the different attempts at understanding probability run into this kind of problem someplace or another. So this is the way I like to see it. Here is this beautiful structure, quantum theory, that I'm trying to derive from basic axioms. But we have to take the structure and fit it onto reality. We need something that makes it correspond to reality. So here's a string, here's a picture, a beautiful frame. here's a piece of string, and here's a tatty old rusty nail, that's sticking here, and it's hammered into the wall. The wall representing the actual empirical constant, or the actual thing that we're measuring. Okay, and there are all these cracks as a consequence because you have to hammer it in properly. And I can't do anything about this because I haven't solved the problem of interpreting probability. And that's a big problem in interpretation. What I'm hoping to do is derive this beautiful picture down here and ignore the cracks. So now I want to find a crucial notion in what I'm doing. This is the notion of states. Okay, it's a notion that we use in physics all the time, and we don't often think about what it means. But often people, when they say state, they think that what you mean by state is that you're providing a description of the way reality is. You're describing a description of some picture of reality. You're giving a picture which actually corresponds to the way reality is. So in Newtonian mechanics, you might say the state is given by specifying the position and the momentum of all the particles. Okay, and that provides an actual picture of what's happening in reality for these particles moving around in certain positions and momentum. But in quantum theory, as you're all very aware of by now, there's a lot of problems with saying what we mean, what kind of picture quantum theory is actually providing. So we're going to run into problems if we use a notion of state which hinges on certain ontological commitments about the nature of reality. Okay. So we don't want to do that. So I'm going to give a notion of state which, to some extent, within this framework anyway, avoids such commitments. So the state is defined to be that thing represented by any mathematical object which can be used to calculate any probability. So I should say the probability. The probability of that. For any outcome, for any measurement. So first of all, just to understand what it is. So what it means is, if you have this mathematical object which represents the state, then you can. And I should say the state is associated with a preparation. Okay. And let's ignore the transformation. For instance, we can always regard the transformation of the measurement as just a bigger measurement. So now we have this preparation. We're going to perform any measurement. Measurements have some settings, okay, and then they have certain outcomes. We want the state to be able to give us the probability for any outcome for any measurement. Okay. So to answer Joe's question, why do I say this? And I mean, this is maybe a philosophical disposition I have. I think there's a difference between the notion of state and the mathematical object used to represent it. And that's especially clear because you can use different mathematical objects to represent the same state. I think there's a confusion in physics. People often think that physics is just pure mathematics. And consequently, they think that the physical objects are actually just the mathematical objects, but they're not. The mathematical object represents the physical object. And you could choose many different mathematical objects representing the same physical object. In just trivial ways, if a mathematical object has these numbers in it, okay, I could represent those numbers by A, B, C, D. Okay, that's a good representation. I could represent them by this funny-looking object. Okay, I'm not sure what that object is, but I can use that object to represent it. And there's no real.
Do we think of another example being when our mathematical object is an incomplete representation of the state? For example, the density matrix of a mixed state?
I mean, that's a different sort of question. I mean, here I'm just talking about the possible confusion between the thing itself and the thing representing it. Whereas that's a sort of particular example where you're considering one detail of representation, one detail of specification on Earth, which is not what I'm talking about here.
It looks like this definition would include a mixed state.
Sure. This definition is rich enough to include all mixed states, for sure. The point I'm making here is just the same point that Marguerite was making when he did that painting with a pipe. This is not a pipe. This is the same point. Actually, he didn't. He said it in French.
It seems to me that this is at least pretty much equivalent to a simpler statement: the state is the result of preparation.
No. I'll answer that in a moment. Yes, I
think. Yeah. So, well, you haven't yet used this term in this axiom. But is this an axiom? Is the axiom systems we use this term as an axiom system for a piece of mathematics, because you're using this term to point to something which is not mathematics.
Sure, this is not, yeah, I mean, this is really, I might have made a mistake right at the very beginning when I called it absence. It's a really physical postulate that apply to physical systems. I'm not implying, and I'm not trying to achieve here some very formal, axiomatization of quantum theory. That's quite the opposite. We're trying to, you know, answer this, I'm trying to keep this cozy feeling by writing down a set of principles that you can use to derive the quantum structure.
I mean, how is this different from if you've seen pictures, many pictures of a particular photograph, say, the Queen of England, and you've also seen representations in a movie and on television and so forth, and you say, you know, the state, you are hypothesizing that there is something in reality which all these pictures give partial information about.
Right. I'm trying not to allude to some ontological thing here. I'm saying that a mathematical object which can be used in this framework to make predictions for the probabilities. Okay, without alluding necessarily to anything without alluding to anything but this.
But what is the word thing doing there? The first word thing, that thing.
Oh, it's referring. It's referring to this.
Is it referring to the thing that is referred to by that?
Okay, I wasn't expecting to get into this this statement.
Maybe
it's better just with examples, because I think I need to clear what I mean. Okay. So here's an example. I could just write down a long list, which is room for here, but okay, here's a long list. Okay, of probabilities. The alpha is a label which runs over every possible outcome for every possible measurement. Okay. Of course, in principle, this label might be continuous label. Anyway, imagine I write down this long list. Well, then, just by definition, I've given an object which represents the state. Okay. And that's fine, except you might say, well, this is crazy. You've got to put all this information in here. I'm sure you shouldn't have to do that. And then you can say, well, perhaps in any given physical theory, you might have some structure, which means that rather than writing down this long list, you can write down a shorter list. Okay, well, you pick out a particular set of outcomes, a particular set of outcomes associated with measurements, okay, and you write down the probabilities associated with both. Okay, so we're picking out a subset of alpha and relabeling them 1 through to k. Okay, and then we define this object here to be such that this is sufficient to calculate the probability for any measurement. Okay. When you say thing there, you don't mean physical thing. You're just talking about an abstraction. Yeah, it's an abstraction. It's the abstraction of the state. Here's another mathematical object which can be ready to represent the state. I'm going to give that a name. I'm going to call it represented by this vector B. Okay. There's two important points. One, this list is meant to be just sufficient. Okay. Actually, I should be slightly more careful about that. It's meant to be just sufficient up to normalization. This list is meant to be just sufficient up to normalization. And the other thing is, I want to point to k. K is important. discussion big. Okay. So this is the notion of space I'm going to be working with, where we have this object. Are there any questions on this? Okay. So how do we use this object to calculate the probability? So I make some particular measurements and I want to calculate the probability, and the guarantee this object is rich enough to do that. So the probability is given by some function, some p. Okay, now we can actually show that this function is linear by considering preparations which are mixtures of other preparations. Okay, I'm not going to go into that group, but this is something that we can show. But actually, this is a logical approach, which is rather than trying to show that this function is linear, you just define this object to be a list of probabilities. So this object here to be a list of probabilities, which is just sufficient to calculate the probability by a linear formula. You can put the linearity into the definition of k, okay, and that will work also. And then you can show that the k defined that way is actually equal to k defined the other way. Okay.
I guess I find that a bit peculiar. I mean, given that, I guess basically you can make that claim because we have some knowledge about the universe behaving in a linear way.
It's really just that. So if I give you the second way, which is the simplest way, without having to do the derivation, then it's just a definition of k. So to make that clear, so imagine we start with this list, okay. Then my k mesh, I can just pick out by this method, particular alpha. Okay, so in that case, you have a linear formula. Okay. So we can certainly get a linear formula. There's nothing that stops us doing that. Then we just say, well, how much can we compress this thing here and still keep a linear formula?
Can you be guaranteed? Sorry. Basically, what would ensure that you have a finite or even a countable number?
No, like, nothing at this stage. Nothing.
So in that case, it doesn't define k so much as it just defines the dimension of the vector.
Sure. K would actually be, at this stage, k could be infinite. Are you not countable yet? Absolutely.
Okay, so suppose, to use the example you keep using, I have this coin, then I can put in my probability vector, if I flip the coin once, I have a 45% chance of heads. Maybe I also have to put in 50.5% chance of tails, right, whatever. Now, if I do some measurement, like flip it twice, then if I ask the odds of anything, I don't see how I can get that as a...
Okay, hold on. You're talking about taking the same point, looking at it, and looking at it again?
Sure. Yeah, that sounds fine.
Okay. I mean, you couldn't deduce it from this object you just did. Okay, you can't deduce it within the framework. Okay, but I don't want to get into that. Maybe once you start to see how this framework works in classical and quantum cases, see how that might go. The point is you have to consider a transformation between the two. The statement has to be rich enough to predict. But that I don't show it.
Okay.
All right. We have seen there's a constraint on that. Okay. So we've looked at states, which are now represented by this p vector. We have the measurements. So now measurements are actually represented by this. Okay, any measurements has an r vector associated with it. So one more thing, which is the transformation. Okay, well, you can show that P transforms linearly for the same reason that this does. Okay, reason is that the state afterwards just has coefficients, has entries rather, in the vector, which are just property system measurements. So if this thing is linear, then of course this has to be linear as well.
We assume that W is conserved. So
sorry?
If W is conserved somehow, so there are some restrictions for sending this object Z.
So actually, in the framework, the way I do it is I have this null result, okay, and actually I just list probabilities for the non-null results, and then probability needn't be conserved. However, if you
don't get increased anyway.
It can't increase. However, if you include the probability for the null result, which I don't, if you do, then you have a string. And incidentally, you might think that you just have to add all these probabilities to one in the list, but that clearly isn't true, because their probabilities corresponding to, in principle, different measurements. Okay, so they don't add up to one. However, some linear combination of those probabilities will add up to one if the state is normalized. Okay. If the state is always going to give rise to a non-null result. Okay. There's one more thing I want to define at this stage, and then I'm going to give you classical and quantum theory in this framework. I want to define an object, called n. Okay. So n is the thing that's equal to the dimension of the Hilbert space in quantum theory. In classical probability theory, it's equal to the number of distinct possibilities. So operationally, n is defined to be the maximum number of states that can be distinguished from one another in a single shot measurement. So to give an example, in quantum theory, you can distinguish spin up and spin down eigenstates by a measurement of spin along that direction. Okay. So there, n is equal to 2. Okay. You can't find any more states that can be distinguished. Okay.
Is that the same as saying it's the number of possible outcomes of the theorem?
No, no. Because you can consider measurements which correspond to P of the empty quantum theory, which you might not be familiar with. But for example, if I have a spin particle, I pass it through a standard Laplace apparatus, then one of the two arms, maybe I pass it through a not very good standard Laplace apparatus. Then one of the two outputs I pass through a second standard apparatus, which is good. Okay, well, I have three possible outcomes then. Okay, but actually, the other space for the spin half part is just two dimensional. But I'm still making a measurement. This is formalized in PLEMs. Okay, which should be false. I mean, very much causes on quantum theory.
So,
I
guess that this is coming down to, in your statement, you said something about a single short measurement.
Single shot.
Okay. So is n the same thing as the number of possible outcomes of a single shot?
Not even that necessarily. I'll okay, maybe that's the question. So you can think of it like this. So imagine I have a set of possible preparations. Here's my preparations. Okay, and I'm sending them on to measurement operators. Different measurement operators, which has, I'm ignoring the null outcome, has many possible outcomes here. Okay. Now it might be that I can find a set of measurements where, so I find a set of states, where the first state, P1, always gives rise to one of these outcomes for this thing. The second state always gives rise to another set, and so on. Okay. Then I would know by looking at which outcome I had, which state I had on the initial set. Okay, so this will be a way of distinguishing each of the states in the set which have this property that can give rise to disjoint possible outcomes. And then you can say, well, n is the largest number of states that can appear in any set of that region. But it's really just the operational thing that corresponds to the dimension of the Hilbert space.
So the subscript on B here is referring to outcomes, and here the subscript on B is referring to preparations?
This subscript is referring to the distinct possible preparations.
And that one up there, so that the same for different outcomes?
Well, that was actually referring to these, to the different components in the text.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, maybe to make it less confusing, but it's a different thing to write. Okay.
So, this distinction between n and the number of possible outcomes seems to be.
Can I suggest if you read study theorems? Did you study theorems? Because it's really crucial. So look at theorems and you'll see there's a big distinction. Between these two concepts.
I was just wondering, is the idea that it's a single shot measurement doing anything important to
it? Well, you could ask
just in theory, you could
just ask for a property to equal to 1 and 0, and that's what I'm asking for. That the first state has property 1 and giving rise to one of these outcomes, and 0 to the others, and so on.
I find myself wondering whether or not the concept that this is a single shot experiment is conflicting with the definition of probability involving many experiments performed one after the other. So the idea that this is an experiment that you know from prior experience will have probability 0, 1, and then you consider performing it once.
Yeah, that's not what I have to say. You know from prior experience, you have these properties. So now you're given, if you're told you have one of these states, you're not told just one. Then, in a single shot, you can distinguish.
So single shot means don't do it over and over again in the same preparation.
All states can be distinguished if you have sufficient number of repetitions of the experiment. You can distinguish spin up along the z direction from spin up along the x direction just by doing enough measurements of those repetitions.
Okay, so. So where are we? So what I want to do now, rather quickly, is give you classical and probability theory in this kind of framework. And then I'm going to essentially give you the axioms which will introduce you to quantum theory. So let me just do this with examples. So here's an example for a classical framework. Actually, one thing I should point out here. For this entire analysis, we're dealing with the case where n is finite. Okay, and this addresses the concerns that were raised earlier, that k should be finite. Okay, this entire analysis is going to be in the case where n is finite. And one point we could discuss that restriction later. So let's consider a classical system. So this box is different to those boxes. This is a natural system where we imagine we have a classical form, which can be in this box, or it can be missing. Okay, either it's here or here, or it's not there at all. Okay. Well, we can write down the probability of being in box 1, the probability of being in box 2, and then the state given by this object. And the states which are allowed are where these two numbers add up to less than or equal to 1. So there are states in this region here. So any point inside or on this surface is an allowed state. There's special states. This state here and this state here are somehow special. This state corresponds to the particle being in box 1, and this one corresponds to the particle being in box 2.
I think I have another property, which is that if I take two terminal states, okay, P, A, P, D, okay, which are in this region somewhere, and I take a convex sum, that means I take some positive number mu, times it by the first one, and then some positive number, so then one minus the same positive number, and mu is between 0 and 1. Okay, and I add those two numbers together, and I can get another one. So states which have this property are called mixed. In the case that the state doesn't have this property, then we call it a pure state. And these are pure states. But operationally, a pure state is a state which cannot be prepared by taking a mixture of two other preparations. So we have this notion of pure states. And what's interesting is that in this case, we have a countable, a finite number of pure states, a discrete set of pure states.
Will you consider the null state in the corner in the origin also as a pure?
That's actually, yeah, so the way I define pure states in the paper is pure states any state except the null state, which are extreme, which are not case. Okay. Let me just give you a few other details about this. Imagine you want to make a measurement on this system. So one measurement you can make is where you look and see if the ball is in box one. The probability that you see ball in box one is equal to this. Okay, and similarly, if you want to make a measurement for ball being in box two. And then, if you imagine you want to make a general measurement, where what you do is you toss a coin. If the coin comes up heads, you look to see if the ball is in box one. If the coin comes up tails, you look to see if the ball is in box two. Then, and that's the correct expression for calculating the probability. Okay. And this object is just an R. And actually, any measurement that you can make, including the ones where you make successive measurements that I don't have time to explain how to do this, can be written in some form like this. Okay. Whatever.
You can't distinguish between not looking and not being in your state.
Say it again. Don't you distinguish between?
Like, if you're not looking would be 0, 0 for R.
If you're not looking, it's a different experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but like. Oh, right. Okay. So this experiment.
You just can come up with zero probability either way. I don't know.
Okay, right. I think these vectors have to refer to a well-defined concrete measurement. So maybe what you're listening, you're describing is actually something that's well-defined ontologically, not well-defined in terms of this. Okay. Any more questions? So this is really just an example of this general R dot P that I was talking about earlier. The other thing you can ask for is, what about transformations in this framework? Just do that here. So in that case, you'd want to have Z, it's some object where, well, if the transformation is such that the total probability is conserved, if the ball, if there initially stays there somewhere in one of the boxes, then you'd want the the columns, I think, add up to one. So you want the columns add up to one. Okay. And those things are called stochastic matrices. So when we set up this framework, classical probability theory, the thing that I want you to bear in mind is this graph. This table, this graph here, with the fact that we have pure stakes, just two of them. So now let me do the same thing, or similar thing, for example, in quantum theory. So in quantum theory, as we know it, the state is represented by density matrix. Okay. And imagine this is a density matrix for a spin half particle. Well, then it would just look like this. This is spin up probability along the z direction, and this is spin down probability along the z direction. Then A. Well, you can write A. This can be an exercise.
Yes.
This can be an exercise. To find the correct result. I'm not sure if I remember it right. Anyway, the point is, A is equal to a linear combination of the probability for Px plus Py plus Pz plus and Pz minus. See, that's...
So,
as a hint in the exercise, use the property that this has to be a positive operator. Okay, and don't assume that it's normalized initially. Don't impose normalization. Okay. So, that might be surprising because we're used to thinking of this as being some rather abstract things. They can just be regarded as coming from the probabilities. So, what this means is that this object here is. It's an equivalent representation of the state for this object. There's another object. This object has the same information as this object. If I know this, I can calculate this. If I know this, I can calculate this. That should be a wide. So actually, a particular example would be if we have a spin particle which is prepared to spin up along the z direction, and this is equal to 1, 0, half. That's an example. And this is just a spin. And in particular,
you have a y plus in your equation and a y.
Yes. Actually, this
it
would work with
mine. It would work with
mine.
Yeah.
Good. So what we can do is we can draw a graph like this. Pz plus Px plus Py plus, and I'm just going to impose the normalization condition. Pz plus Pz minus equals 1. You don't have to impose that, but I'm going to impose it now. I'm imposing it just because then we only have 3 variables rather than 4. See how it is. So I can now represent it on this 3-dimensional graph. And now I'm going to draw a unit cube in the first octant. So
So that's a unique view in the first octant. And now I'm going to take a sphere and place it just inside this unique view, so it just fits inside. It's just difficult to draw a unit sphere. Sorry?
The unit sphere, or?
Well, the diameter is what diameter one, so I'm not sure what unit means, so the diameter one. So this unit sphere is located, has a center located at the center of the scheme. Okay. So you can do a calculation, and you can show that the allowed values for these states, so for these parameters, the allowed position for this state, given this normalization condition, has to be that they are either on the surface of this ball or in the interior. Okay. Every vector of this form, just putting in the normalization condition, has to either lie on the surface or inside the interior. You might have seen a similar thing, which is the Bloch sphere. Is Bloch sphere being covered?
Yes, I think it was covered by one of the subcontractors.
Okay. So the Bloch sphere is just the same object, but it's slightly translated coordinates. The sphere is taken to the center and it's the coordinates are. I think we make the sphere bigger. It's the same mathematical object. Okay. So here's the crucial point I want to make here. If I take two pure states, well, they're represented by points on the surface of the sphere. And I'm able to evolve the system applying a unitary transformation so that I go continuously from one point to another. So let me just write that down. That's actually axiom. I should have been writing the axiom as I was going along. That's actually the crucial axiom. So let me write it down. So the crucial axiom is that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. This axiom isn't true in the classical case. The word continuous doesn't apply. Okay. So while I'm over here, just one more thing I want to point out. So in quantum theory, the probability is given by the trace formula. Familiar to you. If I have a state rho and a measurement given by a positive operator A, then this is the correct term probability. And that is equal to R dot P. Okay, and you can check this. It's actually quite instructive to go through and do the mathematics, although I won't set it in an exercise if you're looking at one of the papers. This object is linear in this object. Okay. We saw that already. These two objects are linear inside in each other, and therefore this object will be linear in this object. So just as you can find a way of going from this object to this object, you can also find a way of going between these two objects. So we can see that the R dot P approach works just as well in quantum theory. Okay. So I've tried to give you a sort of an oversight of the framework I'm looking at and how quantum theory and classical probability theory fit into it. Let me just give you now the remaining axioms. So axiom, I'm going to go through them in a funny order. Axiom three. Okay. Composite systems. If I have a composite system made out
two systems A and B. And I haven't really defined very well what I mean by that, but just to give the axiom, I don't have time to give you all the details. Then N is equal to NA and B, and K is equal to KA AB. So this one here, I think, would seem reasonable to you. Imagine I have two points. Well, n is equal to 2 for each of those points. So for the total system, n is equal to 4. So the number of distinguishable states, the total system is 4. Okay. And indeed, you take one classical system, put it next to another. The total number of possibilities is just the product of the
information. So this is tantamount to a statement that indistinguishability of states of systems is independent of each other. It's some sort of statement of the independence of the two systems.
So, well, yeah, essentially, let's say like this, that when you put two systems together, you don't get new properties emerging.
Well, two independent systems together.
Yeah, you can put two independent systems where for each of them you can imagine doing all the things I described. And now you just now consider them together, it's not changing anything physically necessarily. But you might change them physically, you don't necessarily have to. So we know at least these two things are true, and therefore we know that this is greater than or equal to this. All we're saying is that when you put, so here's an example. Imagine you have two very simple systems, Alice and Bob. Okay. And Alice and Bob are really simple. They can either be happy or sad. That's the thing about them, incidentally. So n is equal to 2 in each case. If you consider them together, then you have four possibilities: happy, 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 sad, sad, happy, sad, sad. Let me finish the example. It might be that when you put them together, a new property emerges, which is that they can be in love. And actually, that property could be independent of the other properties.
I was actually somewhat concerned that, for example, if Alice is the property that she's an empath, then Alice is always happy when Bob's happy, and vice versa.
She has a property that she's a...
that empathic or something.
Okay, right.
In which case, there's...
You know. Okay, so there are some issues of the sort that you're raising which have to do with whether there are some built-in correlations even between the preparations. Mm-hmm. So it means you have to be careful how you define preparations. You have to say you define preparation for this one and separate preparation for that one, okay, which is part of the sort of structure we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, then the kind of thing you're raising comes up. If you do have separate preparations, then you can just look back and say, well, I've got that happen. Anyway, this property, I think this second property is sort of similar in spirit. It's just saying that when you put two systems together, you don't get any extra properties. It's actually a very beautiful property. It might surprise you that this is true in quantum theory. And this is interesting. It's only true in quantum theory if we have complex Hilbert space. If you have real or polyonic Hilbert space, this property is not true. Mm-hmm. So, turning that around, the explanation for why we have complex numbers in quantum theory, at least from a parameter counting point of view, in this framework, comes from this statement here. Actually, I have time. I want to say a bit more about that because it's pretty interesting. The axiom 2, information. You know, if you've read the papers, I'm now changing the way that I'm taking this axiom. Same axiom, I'm just changing the way I'm stating it. So here's the new statement, which hasn't been published yet. The new statement is that systems which have or are constrained to have the same information carrying capacity have the same properties. Okay, and what I mean by information carrying capacity is just n. Okay, or log of n, to be precise, because that's the number of classical bits that you can use in the system. So this axiom says systems which have or are constrained to have certain information carrying capacity have the same properties. So I haven't actually said precisely what I mean by having the same properties, and I don't have time to do that precisely. But roughly speaking, I mean in terms of their characterization, in terms of probabilities and so on. So
maybe then like equivalent preparations.
Exactly. You could compare you have a mapping between preparations in one case and preparations in the other case. So that the objects P, Z, and R are all the same. Yeah. But I'm not going to sort that out in detail. So an example of this in quantity would be consider the spin of a spin half particle and the polarization of a photon. Both of those are described by two-dimensional quantum spaces. So you can find a mapping between measurements and preparations and transformations in those two cases. So there's four of the axioms, okay. And these four axioms, well, these three axioms I'm quite happy with. The first axiom I'm unhappy with, that's not my fault, because infinity is all true. The fifth axiom I'm not very happy with, but I can't find a way out of having it. It's not such a bad axiom. Let me just write it down in the corner. Okay, so simplicity. And I keep this in the paper, one of the papers that were on the website, if you want the site papers. Roughly speaking, this axiom says that we want to take so we know that k is a function of n. Okay, we know that because of the because of axiom two. K is a property, and so k must become n. So this simplicity axiom is really saying we take the smallest function of n. Okay, and let me just explain how that comes in. There's another property which isn't so obvious, but it follows from axiom two as well. Okay. K of n plus 1 is greater than k of n. Okay, that's not obvious, but it's very reasonable. You'd expect this to be the case. Okay. So if I take these two properties and I combine them with these two properties, you can prove. That k is equal to n to the power r, where r is equal to 1, 2, 3, etc. That's not obvious. I think it took me a week to work that out too. Maybe that should be a homework exercise. it's in your appendix to one of the papers. It really follows from number theory. It's the first time I had to use number theory in my papers. You have to get into number theory of this kind of property. But anyway, here's the interesting thing. The case where r is equal to 1, where k equals n, is just quantum theory. So it's just classical probability theory. This is the classical case. The case where n is equal to 2 is quantum theory. The case where n is equal to 3, 4, etc., we don't need them if they exist. Carol and I have been trying to construct the case for. At least construct one example of that case. We're not sure how we're doing on that. So it's conceivable that this simplicity property isn't actually required. It's possible that already four axioms would have constrained us to this first two cases. But I haven't been able to do that. Okay.
So, what is the simplicity axiom?
No.
Have you actually said what the simplicity axiom is? That it's the simplest possible in some sense.
Yeah. It's a tedious thing to state. It's the you look for you let's say like this, that k takes the smallest value which possible for each n, which satisfies the axiom.
So
practically,
r is equal to 2.
So what it ends up meaning is r is equal to 2. And actually, which is sometimes it's very difficult in words to state something very clear. Okay, so anyway, maybe I should, because it's now close to us, so I will finish with one last comment. The re- one last paragraph, let's say. The reason we require RH2 is because we have this word continuous here. If we drop this word, and we drop this one word, then the whole structure collapses because of the simplicity axiom down into the k equals n case, which is the classical case. And so, if this one word, because all these axioms are consistent with classical probability theory, with the exception of this one word.
And I'm thinking of that word for men.
Well, okay, right. I can do that, but let me treat that as a question. I think it's obvious what I mean. Okay, so this one word is the crucial thing. If you drop it, you get, rather than getting quantum, you get classical theory. So the answer, in some sense, within this framework to Weaver's question, why quantum theory, is this one word that we have this continuous reversible translation. Okay, I'll stop just there.
Just to stab at getting an idea why. The continuity probably fails in this ball in a box example in particular, right?
So we're dealing with
in this case there's a discrete set of peers.
Yeah, but you might argue that I would stab the text in favor of quantum theory because I chose n to be finite. And therefore there was no way of getting that. But it's worth remembering this property has to be true even if you constrain the system to have some inflation carry capacity. So even if you imagine a system with a continuous number of distinguishable states, but picked out a finite set of them, so you can straight to some lower thing, then you still require this continuity property on that discrete set. So at least, although I haven't treated the case technically where you have n continuous, at least there are reasons for thinking that this would still work in that case.
Are there other theories that, other than quantum theory, that can be derived from these axioms?
So quantum theory axioms, you need to give you the structure of quantum theory, which is, I didn't spell out exactly what I mean by that, but roughly speaking, it's this thing represented by a set of symbols on top of the quite secret. So the point is, these axioms you need to give you quantum theory. That's important, otherwise, I would just be stating a set of properties that quantum theory has, which are interesting.
Well, you could get RH3, 4, and so on, which have been ruled out by an element plus an element aspect scheme.
Well, everything is ruled out by hand, but one of the axioms. It depends whether you regard it as ad hoc or principle to have a simplicity axiom. I'm sorry, you need this.
For your information axiom, you're basically saying that anything that can be represented by the same dimensional Hilbert space has the same property.
That's what it ends up being.
Okay.
Yeah. So, of course, when we start with this axioms, they don't have object spaces. We haven't constructed them yet. So we don't want to state axioms in terms of objects we don't even have. But it ends up meaning that.
There's some resulting in quantum computing where you can show that you can store two classical bits in one quantum bit, something like that.
You can imperfectly do that.
Imperfectly?
Yeah, not perfectly, though. Yeah. So you're thinking of the second axiom?
No, I was just wondering about the exponents.
I think it must relate to that. So the fact that you have, for one bit, you have, in the quantum case, you have k equals 4. One qubit, you have k equals 4, whereas for one classical bit, you have k equals 2. And I think that explains why you've got this extra space to imperfectly get extra. And that's probably one way of seeing it.
In action 2, when you say two systems having the same information that I can carry this have the same properties, do you mean physical properties like that?
I didn't get close to me to get what I mean, but I mean really properties in terms of this framework. So let's see, what do we do in the framework? We choose a set of special measurements, the ones that are associated together with this vector. Okay, I call those the potential measurements. Okay. Then when we've chosen those, then we can write down our state. Okay, and the state belongs to a certain set of states. Okay, and then also from that we also get a set of matrices for the transformations, and the set of states are for the measurements. Okay, all those objects.
come from this choice. Now, they have two different systems, okay, but they have the same end. Then I want to be able to choose a set of traditional measurements in each case, okay, such that the objects I talked about map onto each other. There's a mapping between the two cases. So that in terms of the characteristics of these two cases, as far as their probability is concerned, they're the same. Of course, it might mean that in one case, so for example, if you take a, you consider, compare a photon, compare the polarization degree of a photon with the spin degree of an electron. For a photon, if you measure polarization, you measure polarization along, you measure along up, down, or left, right. Okay, whereas, and those represent two orthogonal measures. They would map in the spin case to measures along up or along down. Okay. So there's a mapping, but the mapping is more of this. It's to ensure the properties of the same. Is that
absolutely? So you're saying anything that can be represented by the same end is pretty much polymorphic to each other?
The same.
Like
anything. Same end. Yeah, there is this.
Isomorphism? Well, not necessarily
isomorphism. It might be a sort of a map which is many to one for one direction and one to. So in each case, you have a many to one mapping from say preparations to states.
Many to one.
So many different preparations to the same state in each case. Mm. Okay, and then likewise on the other side. Okay, and then you have a mapping between equivalence classes of preparations, which give rise to one state, in the one case, and equivalence classes of preparations that give rise. In other case.
So you could perhaps map preparations to preparations as well. So an isomorphism of the model in which you have your states.
But it would be better to map. It would be better to map equivalence classes of preparations to equivalence classes of preparations, because there might be many different preparations to give rise to the same state. And maybe that's the best. So there was a question down here.
Okay, is it obvious why we need reversibility in
reversibility? Okay, good question. So we have a. So maybe I should also, in doing that, so the question about whether anybody's seen this as well. So we have a set of transformations. By reversible, what I mean by reversible is that I can have a second box. So I have a transformation here, and then I have a second transformation here, which simply has the effect of whatever state came out of the first one, it sends it now back to the original state. So whatever state went into the original box, the same state comes out again. So in quantum theory, you can find the unit transformation and its inverse perform that fast. And then those reversible transformations form a group. Okay, that's a set of transformations, they form a group. And then in the actual technical derivation, which I haven't gotten into at all, I'm using these group properties to get a space of states. So one way to see that is if I just take the simplest case where n equals 2. Okay, then I have this key vector which has four elements. And I can now rotate it using transformations under a group. And that will end up rotating it into a sphere. Okay, actually it'll be an ellipsoid if you choose your coordinates properly for sphere. And that sphere is just the block sphere that I drew at some point. So it's the reversibility which gives you groups, and the groups act on those states give you this object. So it's essential in the derivation. And of course, one might ask, why is it interesting physically to have reversibility? That's a good question. Maybe one should drop the reversibility requirement. Maybe physical theory shouldn't satisfy reversibility. A general question about this framework is if you're going to go beyond the cozy feeling of having got quantum theory, trying to go beyond it, then you can start to ask which things in this framework should be changed. And I think the word reversible is probably one of them. One shouldn't be requiring this in a deeper theory, but having quantum theory.
Okay, so I think by continuous, you actually mean connected, because it seems like the transformations are all continuous.
Okay, so let me just define what I actually mean by continuous. Let me define it in more operational terms. Imagine I take a transformation. Okay, I want it to be if this is a continuous transformation, it means I can make it out of many small transformations, okay, which put them one after the other, which is a big transformation. And by small, by infinitesimal, what I mean is that the probability for any measurement before and after this transformation is only affected if we test it. So that's what I mean.
Yeah, so in other words, any two states are related by a transformation which is pathnetted to the identity.
That might be my equivalent, but one thing I found didn't work is I couldn't say I didn't maybe there's a way doing this. I couldn't, because the axiom I initially started from here, which failed, was that there exists a continuous path between a pair of pure states through the pure states. Okay. And that doesn't work. At least I couldn't make it work. Maybe it can work.
Continuous path of transformations. It doesn't imply that continuous path of transformations give you.
Oh, yeah, that does give you. Yes. So one is equivalent. So this is equivalent to the statement that there exists a continuous path between any pair of pure states through the pure states. Okay. You can go that direction, but I couldn't go the opposite direction. And I don't think one.
Okay. A physical question about this, though. It seems to me this implies photon decay. Proton decay.
I don't believe you.
Because if you have a quantum field theory with super selection sectors of some kind, then in fact you have things are disconnected.
Okay.
So you can't, with this setup, you cannot have
okay, sure, okay, it's good, right, okay.
Number.
So yeah, so I think so what I'm aiming at with this framework is this basic framework for quantum theories. I think you have to actually you have to address the question of super selection sectors or super selection principles in quantum theory and aggregate them. So there's different ways you can imagine doing that. One way would be to say where you have to actually go about modifying these axioms. You know, I mean, this would fail, for example. I mean, various axioms here would fail, and then this would fail for the reason you suggested. So one could try and do that in some framework that covers super selection. A deeper approach might be to say, well, there are reasons in the dynamics that certain transformations, although they are at least in principle there, get suppressed, and so they don't exist in practice. I don't.
In other words, the photon decays very slowly.
Or there's some reasons that there's a process of maybe. Okay, so I should take these questions first.
There are other people working on axioms as well, I believe. Is there any kind of one-to-one correspondence between your axioms and your axioms and dealing with that?
So there's certainly not a one-to-one correspondence. The only one-to-one correspondence is that I claim I get quantum theory, they think I get quantum. One quantum correspondence is the things we take together. The axioms themselves, I don't think so. So there's been various work on axioms in quantum theory. There's the early work in the quantum logic tradition, where I don't know if anyone spoke about that at this lab. Okay, so okay, good. So you'll hear about that. So I think this is quite different to that approach. Although there has been some work in a more operational framework which has similarity to this, but it's not the same as the set of axioms. There's another approach taken by Clifton and Harrison, which may be what you're thinking of. And not just like their claim, and not just like that they really actually succeeded in constructing quantum theory. Even if you take it as given that they have, it's a very different framework. They start off by assuming this abstract type of space, this which is where you're putting a lot of mathematical structure into the framework before the physical structure. And then they take some, which I don't think they want to do that, but it's just this stage. And then they take some various information theoretic axioms. In fact, they take big commitments, the impossibility of big commitments, as an axiom, in the same spirit that the impossibility of heat engines that go in reverse, or, you know, or perpetual, the impossibility of a perpetual motion machine. They take it in the same spirit that you might take the impossibility of a perpetual motion machine as an axiom. And I think that's a very strange axiom. There's already a lot of difficult things to define, and to take that as an axiom of quantum theory and drop it is a rather odd thing to do. So I'm not so impressed with that. Although something simple might work. It's quite different. Okay, so Nathan was just
what's fit, Nathan?
Okay.
Sometimes I know what they are.
Okay, so we have an expert on the limits at the back pages. answer that question. So it's like this. Imagine. Actually, I don't answer that because I think you can ask Adrian. He'll tell you and you deal with it. That's the bottom stage. So it's
Yeah, you said k to be flatly infinite, but you constrain n to be finite, right?
Yes. So what happens? So what's like this? I deal with the case where n is finite. So you just say k
is infinite. Yeah. No, n is finite. Yeah.
Okay.
But doesn't that limit you to finite dimensional Hilbert space?
Yeah. So there's two types of answers to that question. Okay, so we're going to give you both types of answers. I think you're saying which one of them. So one type of answer is to say, well, you know, conceptually, it's what we know to do with a minor n case, and then getting to the continuous n case is a technical problem which I haven't really addressed yet, but might be interesting in this framework. And the reason to think it might be interesting because even in the continuous case, we can still constrain down to finite numbers of distinguishable states. Okay. So at least, although I haven't done it technically, at least it's likely that one could make a go of that within this framework and still get quantum theory. So that's one answer to the question. The other answer to the question is that I don't care. So there are various reasons for that. So I don't think that there are reasons coming from quantum gravity that probably ultimately space is discrete, and so we have actually a finite dimensional orbit space at the deepest level, and so the continuous dimensional. Any continuous dimensional space is just an approximation to describe some more fundamental finite dimensional space. So then there'll be no, that's just an approximation, that's just a kind of approximation of the computational. There'll be no reason to try to derive it in a set of axioms. So that's one reason not to care. Another reason not to care is that all the data we ever collect is ultimately finite. So you can't ever from data give support for there being even a continuum, you certainly can't give support for there being. Minimum the number of distinguishable, continuous distinguishable states, it just becomes a strange mathematical abstraction that doesn't have an obvious counterpart in the data you collect. And then there's another question, another reason for not caring, which is that, I think this advances is really a staging point for going beyond quantum theory. And I'm sure if you go beyond quantum theory, then you will get into some kind of fundamental disagreements. And there's another place in this active framework where you actually do have continuity. Although these numbers are discrete, these p's are continuous. Okay. So you have, for example, a probability 1 over root 2, which is a crazy thing because you could never measure probability 1 over root 2. The data could never support probability 1 over root 2. I don't think that kind of thing could actually appear in the framework eventually. So I think there's all sorts of things you might want to change.
That's the most perfect.